It's good to see everybody. We've got a good crowd this morning. I want to welcome, we have a new commissioner, Commissioner Morian. Welcome aboard. So, and officially confirmed. Congratulations. And then we have a few other commissioners that have been here for a while, and they're now officially confirmed. So I guess we can all vote and do everything legally, and we're ready. I also want to recognize we have some previous commissioners that were on the commission previously. Dick Morrison, George Boland, and Tim Hickson are here. Stand up, please. Yeah, thank you. Thank you all for coming today, and what we're trying to accomplish up here is based on what you all accomplished in the past. So I appreciate your service and everything all three of you did, and lots of other people that have served on this commission over the many, many years. So it's a pleasure to be here. With that, we'll open officially. The meeting is called to order May 28, 2009 at 9:05. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Smith has a statement to make.
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I would like for this fact to be noted in the official record of this meeting. I also want to join the chairman in welcoming all of you to the commission meeting today, and just a couple of minor little housekeeping items for those of you who have not joined us in the past. One, if I could just ask that either you turn off or silence your cell phones and BlackBerries, and if you've got a conversation that you need to have with somebody, if I could just ask if y'all would step outside during the course of the meeting. Also, I know a number of you have signed up to speak on a particular issue. At the appropriate time, Chairman Holt will call you by name and we'll ask you to come forward to the mic and please state your name, and you've got 3 minutes to tell us your position and perspective on an issue. I'll keep track of the time over here. Green means go and red means stop. And so I hope all of you have a chance to share your perspective, and we're delighted that you're here with us today. Thank you for coming.
Is there a yellow?
There's sort of a little warning light that comes on, and it means speed up.
Doesn't mean caution, it means speed up. Okay. Thank you, Carter. Next is the approval of the minutes from the previous meeting, which have already been distributed. Do I have a motion for approval? So move Commissioner Friedkin, second by Commissioner Hickson. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Great, thank you. Motion carries. Next, the acknowledgement of the donations list, which has already been distributed. Hopefully everybody's looked at it. Again, I want to thank all those that donate literally daily, monthly, and throughout the year. Without all that support and help on an ongoing basis, this department couldn't accomplish a lot of its goals. So I want to thank everybody for those donations. Do I have a motion for approval? Okay, Commissioner Martin, second Commissioner Hickson, all in favor? Any opposed? Okay, motion carries. Thank you. Next, we'll do one of my favorite things, the service awards.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the commission. We have the privilege today to recognize colleagues that have served with this department with great distinction for long periods of time. We're going to start off with a goodbye to one of our colleagues, Joan Glass, who's been a biologist with us for 20 years in inland fisheries. She has worked in our kills and spills team, which, as all of you know, is the group of biologists that investigate the impacts to our natural resources from oil spills and natural disturbance events like hurricanes and tornadoes. She's been a very dedicated employee, represented the department very well, particularly on water issues up in North Texas and the Panhandle, and served as the departmental representative there on the Llano Estacado Water Advisory Group. And so Joan Glass has been with us for 20 years, and we celebrate her retirement today and wish her all the best in the next phase of her life after Parks and Wildlife. Let's give Joan a big round of applause. Joan.
Okay.
For those of you who've not had a chance to go to Washington on the Brazos, you absolutely should. It is one of our flagship historic sites in the system. Obviously, you know the importance of that to Texas history. Very, very special place, and one of the things that makes it special are our colleagues that work there. And Sally Stoltz has worked there for 35 years for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. She was the office complex manager there for Washington on the Brazos and the Barrington Living History Farm in Fanthorpe Inn. She actually retired after 34 years of service, but then couldn't stay away. She had a little separation disorder complex, fortunately, and came back to work for us again there on site. And so it's a great privilege to recognize Sally for 35 years with Texas Parks and Wildlife. Sally Stoltz, please come forward. Jimmy Rodriguez has been with the department for 3 decades, and he has left his fingerprints on the Texas Hill Country, literally and figuratively. He started out at Lost Maples, helping to open up out of our first state natural area in the system, then moved over to Guadalupe River State Park, where he helped open that state park, went over to Enchanted Rock to work there for a number of years. I was at Kerrville Shriner Park, which is now part of the city park system there in Kerrville, and currently serving in the Hill Country as director of our operations and safety, and really takes a great deal of pride of implementing our minor repair program there in the region and working with his colleagues throughout the Hill Country State Park system. And Jimmy's been with us for 30 years. Real proud to call him a colleague. Jimmy, please come forward. The next individual that we're going to recognize has been with us for 25 years, and Paul Kiesel, great story. He applied for a job with this department 41 times before he was hired, and shame on us and the hiring managers is all I've got to say. Paul was hired after what only can be described as persistence, and placed at Lake Houston. Did a lot of work there at the San Jacinto Battleground Complex, was promoted to be ultimately superintendent at Inks Lake, and is currently our complex manager there at Eisenhower State Park up there on Lake Texoma. And had the privilege of working with Paul this year on some pretty complicated things having to do with the Corps of Engineers and our lease and a concessionaire and marina agreement, and Paul has just handled that very, very well, and very, very proud of his leadership and all he does for our state park system. 25 years, Paul Kiesel. Paul, please come forward.
Glad you stuck around. Congratulations.
The next individual that we want to recognize has been with us for 30 years, also in our state park system. And David Bishophausen, literally and figuratively, works out in God's country. He is our complex manager there at the Davis Mountain State Park and Indian Lodge, which I know some of you have had the privilege of staying in, that wonderful old restored CCC structure, Balmoray Springs, arguably the greatest swimming hole in the state of Texas. And he started with us as a summer intern, worked at Fort Lancaster and Fort McCavitt, now obviously there in the Davis Mountains, very involved in the Chamber of Commerce and the Texas Mountain Trails region, helping to promote nature tourism out in that area. And let's celebrate David's 30 years with the department. David, please come forward. Every once in a while in state parks, Walt Dabney takes a vacation or turns his back, and we hire or promote a Red Raider just to see if he's paying attention. Brent Leisure is one of our most vocal advocates, shall I say, for the red and black, much to Walt's chagrin. Brent has been with us for 25 years, had a very long and storied career in state park, worked as superintendent right over here at McKinney Falls and over at the Bastrop-Bisher Complex. Now our regional director for an area that spans from Huntsville State Park all the way over to the Guadalupe River in Government Canyon there in the Hill Country. And Brent raises his hand every time we need somebody to do a job on behalf of the department. And the only lapse in judgment that I'm aware of that Brent has had is when he's tried to keep up with Mr. Dabney on a mountain bike and occasionally is known for tumbling over the handlebars. So other than that, Brent has been a great leader in our state parks, and let's celebrate his 25 years with the department. Brent Leisure. I think, as all of you know, we've got a very dedicated team of biologists on the coast that work to protect our bays and estuaries and our fishery stocks and our natural resources there. And Winston Denton has been a biologist with us for 20 years, stationed up in Dickinson there at our marine lab, one of our experts at kind of assessing impacts to the bays and estuaries and habitats after major storm events like Rita and Hurricane Ike. He's been the department's liaison to the oil and gas industry when they have been seeking to get counsel and help as they're doing seismic work on the upper coast, and just represented us very, very well. Winston's been with us for 20 years. Let's celebrate that today. Winston, please come forward. I think, as you all know, one of the hallmarks of the Coastal Fisheries Division has been the long-term data set which they've collected through the gill nets and the bag seines and the trawls. And so they've just given us really a wealth of biological information to help us make informed management decisions about our coastal fishery stocks. And Michaela Hill has been with us as a fish and wildlife technician for 20 years. She has helped with the collection of all of that data during the course of her career with us. Been very involved in interviewing fishermen to help kind of understand their attitudes and perspectives on things, taking care of our equipment. She's been a part of that Corpus Christi ecosystem team, and for 20 years she served us proudly. Michaela, please come forward.
Yes,
Congratulations. Terry Stelly up in Port Arthur was hired 20 years ago by the department to work as a harvest biologist for us up on the Sabine Lake estuary. Really noted for his work on striped bass, worked on a subcommittee in the Gulf States Marine Fisheries Commission on anadromous fish, very involved in East Texas water issues, served as the department's ex officio member on the East Texas Water Planning Board, and just been a real leader in helping us make sure that we have sufficient good freshwater inflows down into Sabine Lake and that very, very important estuary on the Texas Bay. Terry Stelly, 20 years. Terry? Sea Center up in Lake Jackson is one of our flagship hatcheries and outreach program, just a very, very special place. And one of the reasons for that is folks like Connie Stolte. And Connie has been with us for 20 years. I'm going to tell a story that Mike Ray probably was not expecting me to tell. But when Connie applied for a job as a hatchery technician, Mike apparently was under considerable pressure to hire someone out of LSU. I suspect DeRocher was trying to reach across the coastal fisheries and permeate that division. Fortunately, the Better Sense got a hold of Mike, and he went with Connie. She worked her way up as hatchery biologist, and she now leads our visitor center program. You know, we have close to 60,000 visitors a year that come through there. And she leads our very, very dedicated group of volunteers. We have upwards of 900 volunteers, many of them Dow retirees, that really consider Sea Center their own. And she just does a remarkable job of motivating them and engaging them. And so 20 years, Connie Stolte. Connie? I think, as all of you know, Memorial Day kicked off kind of boater and water season in Texas, and that is a huge, huge issue and important time of the year for our game wardens and law enforcement community as they work to ensure that our boaters and swimmers and other recreational enthusiasts are able to operate safely and responsibly on the water. And so it is particularly timely that we are acknowledging the work of Chris Green, one of our game wardens stationed in East Texas. He's been named the Southern States Boating Officer of the Year. And Chris graduated from the Game Warden Academy back in 1993. He's stationed in Smith County, responsible for overseeing boater and water safety, among many, many other things, on the Sabine and Neches Rivers and Tyler Lake and Lake Palestine. And not only has he really excelled in his law enforcement work, he has done everything from helping to get a successful prosecution on a criminally negligent homicide recently in East Texas. He's rescued capsized fishermen that were in danger of drowning. But he gives back to the community, and each summer he finds time to take out adults from the Tyler area that are physically and mentally challenged and wouldn't otherwise have an opportunity to get out on the water. And so Chris exemplifies the best of this department, and he's here today as we celebrate this honor. Chris Green, our Officer of the Year. Chris, please come forward.
Jeff got one here.
We've got the privilege today to acknowledge a long-standing friend and partner and colleague in the parks community. Larry Pressler, as many of you know, has led the Parks and Recreation Department down in the city of McAllen for 36 years. And Larry recently shared the news that he was going to retire. And what's significant about that are a couple of things. One is Larry was really instrumental in working with this department in getting the World Birding Center established. And as Scott Borough and Walt Dabney have noted, he was really a stable force in sometimes a very destabilizing environment. And Larry stayed steady throughout the whole time, focused, helped develop that complex, and in his spare time built a world-class local parks system in McAllen, grew it from about a dozen employees to now more than 150. Had seven parks when he started, now have over 30 major parks, 30 miles of hike and bike trails, established the Quinta Mazatlan Nature Center as part of the Birding Center. Larry has just been a great, great friend to this agency, a wonderful colleague, grew up on a ranch in the hill country that he was telling me a good part of that is now part of Enchanted Rock. So he has contributed to this agency in many, many ways. Scott Borough, a dear friend of Larry, is having eye surgery today, and so keep him in your prayers, and he wishes he could be with us today to celebrate that. Larry Pressler, let's recognize Larry, our friend and colleague. Larry. Russell Fishback and our site manager from the valley, if y'all will come up and Walt and
real hilarious.
Larry's handed me the daunting task, and so has Chairman Ault. So fair enough.
That's what I delegated.
Well done. The last recognition that we want to do is someone who's no stranger to all of you, Terry Irwin, who has led our hunter education and hunter safety programs. He's been such a leader, really internationally, in this effort, and many entities have recognized Terry for his great work in reaching out, not only in Texas, but across the country and across the borders, as he works to train folks internationally on how they can develop hunter safety programs. And our great partner, Safari Club International, is here today to recognize him with their Educator of the Year Award. We have Thomas Saldias, who is their representative. Thomas, by the way, is getting his Ph.D. at Texas A&M. That ought to make you proud, Dabney, in human dimensions. And so he's going to come forward and give this award to Terry. So, Thomas, please come forward.
Mr. Carter, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and distinguished members of the commission. First of all, I would like to thank Texas Parks and Wildlife in behalf of the Peruvian government. A few weeks ago, I don't know if everybody is aware, we were able to bring one of the Peruvian wildlife officials to be trained at Texas Parks and Wildlife for about 15 days. It is the first time that a South American wildlife official has been trained in the North American model of wildlife management. So in behalf of all of the Peruvian hunters and our government, we thank you very much for this great opportunity. In behalf of Safari Club International, I would like to present this award to Terry Irwin, a token of our pledge to educational excellence. He has strived to achieve all the qualities we look for in our recipients. As a personal note, I would like to mention that I met Terry Irwin almost 3 years ago, and during this time, he became a friend, an advisor, and a mentor, and also a father-like figure for me. He gave me the opportunity to work with him, translate the Texas Instructor Trainer Manual into Spanish, and then we traveled together to Peru to conduct the first hunter education program ever held in a South American country. Thanks to Terry's efforts in implementing hunter education in Peru, our law now requires proof of hunter education for any applicant looking for a hunting license in Peru. We didn't have to reinvent the program. We just applied the best we found, and that was the Texas Hunter Education Program. During the last year, Terry has certified students, instructors, and finally instructor trainers in Mexico. And as of today, volunteer instructors from Mexico under the supervision of the Hunting Mexican Federation has certified over 1,500 students. Thanks to his efforts, Mexico has accomplished in 1 year more than was accomplished in the last 10 since the program was implemented in that country. Terry, thank you very much for all your help in promoting hunter education in other countries, much like the model that you help maintain in Texas and across North America. It has been a pleasure and honor working with you over the past 3 years, and I have to have more years of service together. In behalf of Mer Shepard, Safari Club President, and Norbert Ullmann, the President of the International and Development Committee, I'm honored to present to Terry Irwin the Safari Club International Educator of the Year Award. Terry.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Commission, this concludes my part of the presentation today. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. That was wonderful. First order of business is item number one, an action item, approval of a revised agenda. Item number six, designation of nonprofit partners, has been withdrawn at this time. Do I have a motion for approval? Commissioner Bivens, second by Commissioner Martin. All in favor? Any opposed? Thank you. Motion carries. We'll go on now to item number two, briefing research activities of the Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Unit at Texas Tech. They're beating up on you. Walt, where's Walt? We're going to all beat up on Walt today. Anyway, welcome, Mr. Jay Robertson. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, commissioners, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jay Robertson. I'm coordinator of research and technical programs in the Wildlife Division. And I'm here today to introduce you to Dr. Rinaldo Patino, who is leader of the Texas Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit at Texas Tech University in Lubbock. And he will be making a short briefing to you on the work that they're doing there. The federal government has assisted the state wildlife agencies since the late 1930s in conducting research that is essential and important to the declining species of that time and important to today as well. This program provides research expertise on important wildlife conservation issues here in Texas. And it provides postgraduate training to future wildlife biologists and fisheries biologists. On average, about 5% of the research that the Wildlife Division conducts is done through the unit program. And we have four cooperators in that besides the department. There is Texas Tech University, the USGS Biological Resources Division, which is the research arm of the natural resources side of the federal government, and the Wildlife Management Institute. The unit in Lubbock was created in 1989, and we have contributed about $150,000 per year for specific research projects and another $40,000 per year over the last 10 years from the Wildlife Division for general operation of that unit. The unit is led by Dr. Patino, and his expertise and training and experiences in fisheries ecology, physiology, genetics, and toxicology. With him today are Dr. Clint Bowl, the assistant unit leader, whose expertise is in terrestrial wildlife, particularly birds of prey. We also have with us today Dr. Jim Fleming, who is the unit supervisor for the southern region, which covers 13 states from North Carolina to Texas. We have a unit cooperators meeting tomorrow here in the Bass Conference Room, where we'll talk about strategy and plans for the coming year. We also have two graduate students with us who are working on various research projects, some of which are displayed in the foyer out here. If you have a chance to look at the posters in the foyer, please do so. You can see some of the sophistication and modern methodologies that are being used to conduct research. Dr. Patino will be making a briefing for the Commission on the role and benefits of the unit. Dr. Patino.
Thank you very much, Jay. First, I would like to thank the chairman and the members of the Commission for allowing us a moment of in your busy agenda to come and tell you about the Texas Co-op Fish and Wildlife Research Unit and the Wildlife Division for having coordinated our presentation today. We are especially pleased about the timing of this opportunity because this year it happens to mark the 20th anniversary since the start of our operations at Texas Tech. So it has a special significance for us. The purpose, as Jay said, today is to briefly explain to the Commission who we are, what we do, and some of the unique cooperative research opportunities that are available to the various cooperators that govern our activities through the unit. And if I can start with the first slide. This is, some of this has already been mentioned. We are a partnership, the result of a partnership between Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, Texas Tech University, the U.S. Geological Survey, Wildlife Management Institute, and also the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They're all the main partners in the agreement that establishes and governs our operations. We are located on the main campus of Texas Tech University in Lubbock. As has been already said, this is the 20th anniversary. 20 years earlier, we started operations. I think we were first on paper established in 88, but we're first staffed and started operations in 89. And we're also, the Texas unit is one of 39 similar units, cooperative research units, in 37 states throughout the country. The mission of our unit and the mission of the co-op unit program in general is to provide scientific information for use towards the conservation and management of renewable natural resources. And we do that by conducting research. We have unit scientists have our own personal research programs. We also train graduate students, and two of them are here with us today. And we also provide technical assistance as requested or needed. The scope of our research operations, again, it focuses on renewable natural resources of concern to the state of Texas. But many of the issues and problems are transboundary issues, so we also, those issues, we go across borders when needed. And also look at regional, national, or even international issues of that may be of concern. But our focus, obviously, we're here. Our focus is Texas, and one of our main cooperators is Parks and Wildlife. The just to give you a brief explanation of what the roles of the various cooperators are. The USGS Geological Survey provides funding to support currently two federal unit scientists. There's currently a vacancy, a third position that is currently vacant that hopefully things turn around, we might be able to fill in the near future or sometime in the future. We have, by agreement, we have graduate faculty status with the university, with Texas Tech in this case. We advise, supervise graduate students, and we also teach graduate level courses. So we more or less function as a regular faculty member of the university. The university provides laboratory space, office space, and also provides some office staff support. They also provide for projects that come through the unit, provide a discounted overhead rate, which is probably one of the attractive attractive components of the operation. More of the money that is made available goes actually to research as opposed to overhead costs. Texas Parks and Wildlife provides a portion of the base funds that are necessary for our just our standard maintenance and operation costs, as Dr. Robertson mentioned. And all cooperators provide guidance on research directions. As was mentioned, we have our annual cooperators meeting tomorrow, and this is where some of that guidance is provided. And also all cooperators, as they, when they have research needs or we are requested, they provide also funds to conduct the research. Some of the unique opportunities available through the unit for research by the various cooperators is that through the unit, all parties to the agreement, all cooperators, federal, state, and Texas Tech, have access to each other through the unit. They are all equal partners in the agreement. Through the unit also, any of the cooperators have access to any faculty member in the host university, in this case Texas Tech University. So it's not just the unit scientists that we provide the scientific expertise. It's any faculty member within our campus that has a particular expertise that is needed by any of the cooperators. It's accessible for that purpose. The primary, as I mentioned already, the primary mechanism for the cooperative research is the discounted overhead rate that the university provides. All projects that come through the unit, be it federal or state, that come through this cooperative agreement, they enter into the university at a discounted rate of 10%. Standard rates are 45-46%, so it's a significant savings to the cooperators if they come through our unit. Now I'm just going to go very briefly through some of the samples of research that we do. These various projects are explained in more detail in the in the foyer and in the posters that we have, and you're welcome if you wish, if you're interested, to browse through those posters. And if you have any questions, we will be there at the break, and some of our students will be there at break if you have any questions. But we work on lesser prey chickens in the panhandle. We have a number of projects that are either conducted by Dr. Ball, our terrestrial wildlife biologist, or other faculty members on campus that are funded through the unit on lesser prey chickens. As you know, there's a declining population problem with the lesser prey chickens, and that's becoming an issue, so we're dealing with that. Another project, this is a small project in our case, but we have also started a pilot project locally in Lubbock, in the Lubbock Canyon Lake system, looking at golden algae problems. Bloom, there's been problems of golden algae blooms in locally in Texas, so we're addressing those issues, trying to understand maybe what controls those blooms and what can probably do to control them, to manage them. And this is also a statewide concern, but we're dealing with this issue. Wind energy development, it's happening every time. I'm sure you drive to Lubbock, you see more and more wind turbines along the road. And one of potential concern may be the impacts of these turbines on wildlife, birds, bats, flying organisms. And so we're dealing with some of those issues, ecological issues concerning wind energy development. Then this is probably one example of a transboundary issue of concern. The common snook is, until some decades ago, that was a very abundant fish in South Texas and a marine species, but the populations have been declining. This is a concern also in Mexico. I mean, common snook is a transboundary species, and Mexico is also concerned about their common snook fisheries. It's a number of species. So we have a project with some biologists from Tabasco to try to it's a production issue. We're trying to develop techniques to spawn the fish in captivity so they can be used either for aquaculture or for restocking of depleted populations. So this is a concern also that our Mexican colleagues also share with us. So that's briefly, that's what we do, that's what we do, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them, or if you have time during the break, we'll be happy to answer questions before the posters.
Any questions? Lesser prairie chickens, we were visiting out in the, one of your colleagues out
in the hallway. And we were commenting about how because you show the lesser prairie chicken research, and then you're showing the wind turbine research going on, and there seems to be a possibility that these are going to clash at some point. Am I saying that correctly?
I would rather defer that to my colleague, Clint, or to Jay.
Well, as you know, the lesser prairie chicken is on the candidate species list from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And it's been upgraded from 8 to number 2 on that list, so its listing is likely in the future. And we do have a personal history of a larger prairie chicken, the Atwaters, here in Texas, the habitat loss. We think that's related to the decline of the Atwaters. We would like to do, I think, whatever we can to prevent that from happening for the lesser. There are other states involved in this. It's not just Texas. Kansas, Oklahoma, Colorado are all involved in it. So we're looking at everything that has to do with lesser prairie chicken decline, range contraction. But the grouse species, as a rule, are very susceptible to prairie grouse species to overhead obstructions, and they don't tolerate it very well. Forest grouse are a different matter, of course, but prairie grouse are, and that's just one aspect. In fact, the wind energy turbines may be more of an impact on other wildlife species than the lesser prairie chicken. We just don't know, particularly the bat species. So we're investigating it all.
Any other questions, comments for? Well, thank you, and thank you for all the work you're doing. Oh, I'm sorry. Commissioner Duggan.
When do you anticipate that you might issue preliminary conclusions or some sort of report on the effects of the turbines on wildlife?
That really gets into our habitat assessment folks, and there is so much to learn right now about what the impacts of those turbines are on wildlife. Kathy Boydston of our staff is working at the international level with other states and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to establish some guidelines about the impacts, and we will work with her on the research side. We will work with her through the executive office on defining what the future research goals are and what we can say in terms of the impacts at that time. But right now, it's really, it's a new area. We don't know a lot about it. So as far as when, that's, for me, that would be hard to judge. I would say there'll be some guidelines in the near future.
Thank you.
Well, the long-term studies are the very best. Before and after control impacts, a lot of times because these farms are on private lands, we don't have a lot of prior notice. We need a minimum of 2 years prior research on these areas and then 2 years post construction. And that, of course, requires access to those private lands. We need that done across ecological areas in the state, not just the High Plains, Edwards Plateau, but also our coastal areas. So my personal view, and being new to the wind research side of things, is that we will need a number of studies done over a number of years, association type or correlation type analyses, to draw any conclusions about the impact. And it will vary from location to location on which species are affected and what we can do to mitigate those losses.
Commissioners, if I could, I think what you're hearing from Jay is that, you know, there's abundance of caution, but also concern by the scientific community about the emerging wind development and what the impacts may be, both from a direct mortality perspective, the species like birds and bats, but also indirect impacts on the landscape in terms of fragmentation and avoidance, such as you see with prairie grouse that will move their leks and breeding areas long distances away from any large vertical structure. This issue still is very much in its formative stages, and so we don't have a lot of data right now. As I think y'all are aware, we have put together with the wind industry and the conservation community and private landowner community some voluntary siting guidelines that are very much an iterative process as we are updating those for ecoregions in the state. Our first priority is the panhandle because of this issue about the concerns with the lesser prairie chickens and the burgeoning wind energy development in that area. We will obviously keep you all apprised as we develop more data. We are investing heavily with Texas Tech, also with A&M Kingsville, Cedar Clayburgh Wildlife Research Institute, in looking at the issue of neotropical migrant songbirds, and are working with all of our scientific partners to help look into this. But it's safe to say we're still very much in our early stages of trying to ascertain direct and indirect impacts. There's a lot of concern out there, to be fair about this. And as wind energy is growing and growing and growing, it's candidly, it's outpacing our ability to keep up with it from a scientific perspective. Very, very important issue on the landscape.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Take your time.
Thank you.
Obviously very pertinent to what's going on Little League this week. Chairman, excuse me, item number three, briefing Texas Bighorn Society, a 30-year partnership with Calgary.
Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. My name is Calvin Richardson. I'm program leader for Desert Big Game. I'm here today. Oh, did we lose the slides? I'm here today to introduce a tremendous partner of the Wildlife Division, a tremendous partner of the Desert Bighorn Sheep Program. But before I make that introduction, I just want to provide you with a brief historical background of the sheep restoration program in Texas, as well as a little bit on our current status of the sheep population. Historically, desert bighorns occupied most of the mountain ranges of the Trans-Pecos region. We don't know exactly how many sheep there were originally, but by the late 1800s, numbers had declined to about 1,500 animals. By 1905, Vernon Bailey estimated that there were only about 500 desert sheep left in Texas, and the last of the native bighorns were gone by 1960. There were a number of factors that led to the decline, including unregulated market hunting, subsistence hunting by mining camps, early settlers, large numbers of sheep and goats in the early and mid-1900s resulted in forage competition. Barriers such as net wire fencing prevented free movement of sheep. But most importantly, bighorns were unable to cope with the diseases carried by domestic sheep. Early attempts to stop the decline included the prohibition of bighorn sheep hunting in 1903. In 1945, Sierra Diablo WMA was established as a sanctuary for the few remaining bighorn sheep in Texas. And in 1959, propagation efforts were initiated at the 427-acre brood pen at Black Gap WMA, and those efforts were plagued by disease and predation over the next two decades. The sheep program experienced few successes until the formation of the Texas Bighorn Society in 1981 and the construction of the Sierra Diablo brood pens in 1983. This effort, combined with the translocations of surplus sheep from other states such as Nevada, Arizona, Utah, finally got the restoration program revitalized and underway. Over the past 30 years, a strong partnership has evolved between the Texas Bighorn Society and Texas Parks and Wildlife. This cooperative approach is a formula that has worked well in the restoration of desert bighorn sheep to much of their native range in Texas. Annual sheep surveys in August and September indicate an increasing trend in sheep numbers over the past two decades, with a resulting record number of sheep observed this past year of 1,200. Permit issuance has also increased from two permits 10 years ago to a record 15 permits this past year in 2008. And our current population estimate of desert bighorns is approximately 1,500 sheep. This could not have been accomplished without the dedicated biologists who fought through the challenges during the early years and simply stated we would not have desert bighorn sheep in Texas if it were not for the support, the funding, the partnership of the Texas Bighorn Society. Now I'd like to introduce the president of the Texas Bighorn Society, Mr. Robert Joseph, and Vice President, Mr. Charles Walcott.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Robert Joseph, and I am the current president of the Texas Bighorn Society. Charles Walcott is the vice president. The Texas Bighorn Society is an all-volunteer, nonprofit organization solely dedicated to conserving and restoring the desert bighorn sheep in the state of Texas. We have a little over 500 members, and over half of those are life members. In the printed agenda item you have in your packet, there's a list of accomplishments that we're very proud of on Exhibit A that I would encourage you to look at your convenience. What we're going to do now is I'm going to show you a little short 6-minute video which outlines our partnership with Texas Parks and Wildlife and what we have done together over the past 25 to 30 years. You might recognize the narrator on this video. It's Dr. Red Duke from Houston, who is one of the founders of the Texas Bighorn Society. Andrew, could you play the video, please?
The Texas Bighorn Society has been the sustaining force behind the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department's program to restore the most magnificent big game animal to its native range. Of once abundant species across the Trans-Pecos region, Texas desert bighorns were virtually gone by the early 1950s. State biologists began their pioneering restoration efforts in 1954, but the underfunded program not only was limited to success. Although it expanded slowly from the beginning of the Black Gap Wildlife Management Area in 1959 to the Sierra Diablo Wildlife Management Area in 1970 to the Chillicothe Ranch in 1977, the sheep and the restoration efforts struggled. In 1981, the organization that would become the Texas Bighorn Society was founded, and the challenges it faced were immediate, daunting, and ongoing. With amazing and contagious enthusiasm, a handful of volunteers determined that the program could be solved and wasted no time in tackling the myriad of issues that inevitably would be encountered. Using the scientific information and the vast technical experience already learned by the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, the Texas Bighorn Society volunteers and the biologists developed a plan to build 4 10-acre propagation pastures at the Sierra Diablo Wildlife Management Area. In the process, about $200,000 were raised to achieve this goal. Simultaneously, the Texas Bighorn Society worked in the legislature to secure political support for its efforts and develop a valuable working relationship with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department.
Texas Bighorn Society provides critical resources that enable us to accomplish goals that would otherwise be unattainable. And I'm not just talking about money. I'm talking about time and sweat. They consistently provide whatever it takes to achieve success.
The result was an effective partnership that facilitates the society's long-term objective, the restoration of the desert bighorn sheep to their historic range in the mountains of West Texas. As a result of remarkable efforts on the part of both the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and Texas Bighorn Society volunteers, desert bighorns were imported from Nevada and Arizona to be stocked in the brood pastures at the Sierra Diablo Management Area. The investment in brood pastures soon began paying off with surviving lambs. The efficient stewardship of the Texas Bighorn Society Restoration Partnership soon enhanced the program's credibility, and in 1985, it resulted in the donation to the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department a 23,000-acre ranch of prime bighorn habitat that would become the Elephant Mountain Wildlife Management Area. The sheep were gaining in their race for survival. 22 desert bighorns from the Sierra Diablo Wildlife Management Area were transplanted to the Elephant Mountain Ranch, where they have multiplied and thrived. By 1996, the Elephant Mountain herd was large enough to support limited bighorn ram hunts. One hunt, for example, raises money for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department Texas Grand Slam Hunt Program. Ram permits are also offered by the Texas Bighorn Society in its annual roundup and by other conservation organizations chosen by the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Other permits are given to private landowners for sale to hunters. To date, the Texas Bighorn Society has donated more than $1 million to the Texas Wild Beef Restoration Program. Meanwhile, the Elephant Mountain herd continues to expand so that surplus animals have been used to stock the Black Gap Wildlife Management Area. That herd is growing as well. Texas Bighorn sheep are on the move, and so is the Texas Bighorn Society. Society members also gather for one work project weekend a year, investing sweat equity in the bighorns on the sheep-owned turf behind Desert Mountain.
PBS needs people that are willing to get involved. We have, in the past, done a little bit of everything from work projects to land habitat protection enhancements. And a lot of this has been done by a fairly small group of people. Those people gave us the respectability and the working relationship with Parks and Wildlife that makes what we do possible, and ultimately the success of the Bighorn Program.
The best known of the ongoing Texas Bighorn Society project involves the installation and maintenance of remote water guzzling facilities that ensure the bighorns always have a place to drink. Only yesterday, it seemed the future of the Texas Bighorns was in doubt. Today, barely a quarter of a century into the restoration project, more than 1,000 desert bighorn sheep are thriving in Texas. Thanks to the vision, perseverance, and dedication of the Texas Bighorn Society and its volunteers.
When you do right by bighorns, you're doing right by everything else in the mountains, and ultimately the mountains themselves.
Trying to change slides. Hold on. You know, in addition to our great partnership with the Texas Parks and Wildlife, I would be remiss if I didn't include another very important, equally important partner in the Texas Bighorn story, and that is the private landowners in Texas. Today, there are more sheep on private land than there are on public land, and without the landowners' cooperation and support, we would not have a sheep program in Texas. The Texas Bighorn Society does not distinguish its work between working with on public land and working on private land with private landowners. In fact, our last two work projects have been on private land, and we do these projects completely free of charge to the landowner. If they're interested in bighorn sheep and trying to take care of them and protect them, we're there to support them as well. In 2008, that's the wrong slide. Here we go. In 2008, we built two new water guzzlers in the Baylor Mountains on the Baylor Mountain Ranch, north of Van Horn, Texas. This slide depicts our staging area. The water guzzlers we built were actually on top of those mountains in the background. This is our company mule, 21st century style. It carries all of our equipment with a drop line up to the top of the mountain and carries all of the volunteers on the inside. Just 2 months ago, in March of this year, we built two new guzzlers and repaired an old guzzler in the Van Horn Mountains on the, once again, the privately owned Lado Ranch. It's a great group of volunteers. As you can see, the girls that want to work just as hard as the guys. We also encourage youngsters, especially when it's time to drive T-posts, as you can see. Here our volunteers are assembling the apron of the guzzler. These folks are all volunteers. They come from all walks of life, except maybe these guys. I'm not sure what they're doing. This is an interesting photo. It appears that we're building this guzzler on kind of a flat place, but I'll assure you that's really just a ridge, and it falls off about 1,000 feet on each side of it, so it's a perfect place to build a water project for sheep and other animals. Here's one of the completed projects from the Lado Ranch this year. And then, as any of you that know much about us know, after we get through working, we also like to have a little fun. So that's part of our group as well. And it's been a great 30-year partnership. We look forward to working with you in the future. Thank you very much for your time and allowing us to appear before you today.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time. Commissioners, any questions or comments? Well, I'll certainly comment. You know, this is the type of partnership that Texas Parks and Wildlife has been lucky to be involved in, so thank you. And, I mean, this is a heck of a success story. So.
Well, thank you. We're proud of it, but we couldn't have done it without the help of the private landowners, and certainly not without the help of this department and the very dedicated biologists and others that are out there every day doing the work. We get a lot of the credit, but those guys do the work.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. But it does. I mean, I think this is an example of what can happen when everybody's willing to work together. And I mean, the turnaround is pretty phenomenal when you think about going from zero to where we are today. So
we've been very fortunate.
Well, as you said, a lot of hard work by everybody working together. So, again, thank you very much for taking the time. Any other questions or comments?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Item number four, an action item, proposed license and boat registration fee increases, recommended adoption of proposed changes.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Gene McCarty. I'm Deputy Executive Director for Administration. The item before you today is proposed increase in hunting and fishing license and boat registration and titling fees. Just a little background, license fees, both boat registration and titling were last increased by Texas Parks and Wildlife in 2004. Prior to that, we had not increased fees since 1996. So we have kind of a long history of a long period of time between individual fee increases. Just part of the justification here is since 2004, operational costs for the Fund 9 divisions, those divisions directly associated with the hunting and fishing license and boat registration and titling fees, has increased by 6.1% per year. The proposed fee increase for hunting and fishing licenses would be a 5% rolled up to the next highest dollar. This would equate to an approximate $2 to $5 increase per license for most of the most popular hunting and fishing licenses. There are a number of exceptions, and I'll go through those here in a minute. This additional revenue would equate to approximately $3.5 million per year. This kind of gives you an idea of what the fee increase would be for the more popular licenses. The Super Combo would go from $64 to $68. The resident hunting would go from $23 to $25. The resident freshwater fishing from $28 to $30. And the resident saltwater license from $33 to $35. As you can see, that's generally from $2 to $4. The exceptions that I was talking about is, number one, the lifetime license. We would increase that license for the hunting and fishing license from $600 to $1,000, and the lifetime combo from $1,000 to $1,800. This is in an effort to try to get the actuarials back in line with what the original plan was, which was approximately 25 years. The resident shrimp boat captain's license increases from 30 to 50. The reason for this is to try to recapture some revenue lost when the rule was changed to requiring all hands on deck to have a general commercial fishing license. And various resident and non-resident commercial licenses, while their increase would be 5%, the actual value would fall outside the line of the 2 to 5 that I discussed earlier, because they're mostly some really high-value license, high-cost-value licenses. For example, the non-resident hunting license is a $300 license, and a 5% would make $15, so it will go to $315. Boat registration and titling fees, again, a little background. They were last increased in 2004. And I just want to remind the commission that boat registration fees cover a two-year period. The increases these fee increases would be used to improve and update the boat registration titling system, provide improvements in boat theft enforcement, provide additional funding for boat fuel costs for game wardens, and boating safety and BWI enforcement. The proposed increase for boat registration and titling would again be a 5% rolled up to the next highest dollars, with two exceptions, and I'll go through those in a minute. And this proposed increase would generate approximately $1.6 million in additional revenue. As you can see, generally we're talking about, for a vessel less than 16 feet would go from $30 to $32. From 16 to 26 would go from 50 to 53. The two exceptions that I talked about was vessels from 26 to 40 would go up significantly, and vessels over 40 would go up from 90 to 150. And this is to try to get this actual licensing cost more in line with the value of the vessel and the overall impact of the vessel. We also have some other new revenue opportunities that we're including here. One of them would be to implement an administrative fee of $100 for the reinstatement of a revoked license. Another one would be to reinstate the non-resident commercial fishing boat license. This license was inadvertently dropped off of our license category 2 years ago, and we do have a statutory obligation to have that license, so we need to reinstate it. And then we also have the proposed annual lifetime license draw, which basically will be a similar lottery draw for a lifetime license. Action since our last commission meeting, we presented this proposal to the commission in March and received commission approval to go to the Texas Register. We published in the Texas Register on April 24th, 2009, and solicited public feedback via public hearings, web, the U.S. mail, and phone. As you can see, we had 19 public hearing sites scattered across the state. A summary of the public hearing comments are below. For recreational licenses, we received 50 in support, 140 in opposition. For commercial, 24 in support, 15 in opposition. For boat registration and titling, 15 in support and 24 in opposition. For the lifetime license, we got 10 in support and 36 in opposition. And for the lifetime license draw, we received 31 in support, 5 in opposition, and the license reinstatement, 29 in support and 9 in opposition. The staff would request the commission adopt this motion, as you see here, and the amendment is to address. We have reduced the proposed fee increase for the vessels over 40 feet from $200 back to $150. And I'll take any questions.
Any questions? Let me see. We now hear somebody sign up to speak. Will Kirkpatrick on this item? Will?
Good morning. My name is Will Kirkpatrick. I live on Sam Rayburn Reservoir, where I conducted a series of fishing schools for 21 years at Stephen F. Austin State University's facility. Director Smith, we've been told the department needs additional monies from us. In 1998, I was asked by the department to present an overview of the last 30 years of catch and release. This was due to my long tenure as professional angler and fishing guide. In 1999, I was appointed by Director Sampson to the department's freshwater advisory board and reappointed twice. Following my appointment, it was requested I testify before the Texas Sunset Review Board, which was examining the department. This request drew upon 31 years working for the Bell Corporation over much of the United States while fishing and hunting in 21 states and 3 countries. Shortly thereafter, I was requested to set up a meeting in Lufkin to generate funds for an economic study of Sam Rayburn by the department due to Jasper County reneging on a financial commitment. This meeting generated over $25,000. I was recently told by your district managing supervisor that this $50,000 study was falsed from the start, yet the department has used Dr. Robert Ditton of A&M, recognized authority on these type of studies and has done many other similar projects. In 2002, Mr. Drosher requested I set up a meeting with local leaders in Hemphill to gain support of the newly planned freshwater fish hatchery on Toledo Bend, scheduled to cost $13.5 million. In February of 2004, late Commissioner John Parker requested I attend a meeting on this same project, was then proposed to cost $16 to $20 million, but give anglers more bang for their bucks. The last estimate of this project is now $27 million, yet provides less ponds, costs millions extra, and requires more maintenance, which is not much bang for us. In my letter dated September the 5th in 1995 to Director Sanson, I proposed tapping an in-place source of revenue currently utilizing our state's waters for monetary gain completely free of charge. While I've been guiding, I've paid $2,575 for this privilege. These fishing tournaments generate millions of dollars each year for their promoters and individuals, yet pay absolutely nothing additional into the department's coffers. Mr. Drosher will tell you this is only a social issue, yet ESPN paid $44 million to purchase Bass, Walmart, which is the world's largest retailer, and Genmar, a huge boat builder, run a similar series of fishing tournaments, again paying nothing into coffers. The recent Big Bass event on Rayburn drew 7,551 anglers with an entry fee of $200 for 3 days. This total is approximately $1.5 million while paying out approximately $324,000 in cash money. The rest of the event's prizes were provided free or at a significant discount to the promoter who has conducted these events for 25 years. These same tournament anglers were responsible for transplanting a large amount of giant Sylvania onto Rayburn, and God only knows where else it went, while some existing infestations were planned by other tournament anglers. Most of the majority of the time, these promoters and participants do not handle or care for fish properly, and I got the documents for that. If you'd like to know how, I'm going to put Gene on a little spot here. The department's association with some of these tournaments, you might ask him about rubber checks. It's an interesting story. You'll have to do it in private. Mr. Holt, if you didn't have to pay for the auditorium use in professional sports, it would be quite a savings of money. And they don't pay a dime to use these, and it's the same thing. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, you've got a packet. My phone number's there. I'd be more than happy to share everything we've got for you. But the department needs to look at this. I sat here yesterday and listened to Mr. Duggan, the chairman, explain about are we getting enough money for what we're paying? And they're not paying anything. You know, it's if you're a truck driver, and we related to this, if you're a truck driver, you pay about three times for a commercial license what we pay for our individual driver's license. And the reason you pay that is because you use the highway for a source of income. It's the same thing when I buy a guide license. I'm paying for a privilege of using public waters. Just buying a fishing license does not give you that privilege. That only gives you the privilege for private fishing for your own enjoyment. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. I wrote a note. Thank you, sir. Any questions for Mr. Kirkpatrick?
I guess I have a question on that. You know, we did
yes, sir. Correct. Everything that's done, ESPN is owned by Disney. It's the world's largest entertainment network. Commissioner Friedkin, being involved with Toyota, that's a big company. And the reason they do what they do is for the advertising that they get out of it. It's awful good publicity for the, what was it, Toyota Tundra, I believe was their big truck. And they are one of the major sponsors of BASS.
Right, but are we talking about programs that, I'm a little confused, are we talking about programs or tournaments that fund the department or tournaments in general?
Tournaments
specifically, the Toyota Texas Bass Classic funded the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Phil can, you know, speak to the specifics about where that money went, but that's incremental money that the department wouldn't otherwise have?
This one tournament on Rayburn had been there for 25 years.
No, I'm talking about the Bass Classic, which was Commissioner Bivens' question.
The money it generated, the money we were given, I would imagine was a very small percentage when you let in how much advertising Toyota got out of this. Now, the money that we got, that the department got, it's a lot of money to an individual, but it's not a lot of money
for...
Well,
with all due respect, that's actually incorrect, and I'd be happy to walk you through the economics of that.
Okay.
Phil and I can do that at the end of the meeting if you'd like.
Okay.
But I think you need to know the facts in that regard before speaking about it.
Well, it
has been beneficial to the department, and it's been significant, and certainly more significant than it's been for pure advertising bang for the buck. So anyway, we can talk about that later.
They have, there's approximately 1 million anglers, this is using your figures, approximately 1 million freshwater anglers in Texas. We estimate that from the figures I've been given, 6% of them fish money tournaments. And I sat down last night, if you take 1/4 of those, I'm just talking about major money tournaments, not these little $25 entry fee and you get a cup, but major money, which we just had one on the Red River, which is not ours, but... And the first prize was $500,000. So these major, if you take 25% of it, that's 15,000 anglers that are making significant monies off the resource and not paying anything back into other than they buy a fishing license. A lot of their equipment they don't buy, so you don't get revenue in off the Wallet Bro Dingle Johnson. I know for that because I've been with the same largest lure company in the world for over 35 years. And you don't get any money out of the tackle that I get from them.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Right. Thank you, Mr. Kirkpatrick. Any other questions or comments on this?
Okay. Do I have a motion on this action item number 4? Yes, Dr. Krupko.
Before making the motion, I'd like to ask that yesterday when we went over the budget and the sales of licenses and other sources of revenue, it looked like we were $3 million short this year in comparison to last year, and it seems like we're running out of time to make up that deficit. And how would that impact our budget for the year?
We're currently about $2.2 million down in a hunting and fishing license and an additional $600,000 or so in boat registration and titling. And when we did our revenue forecast early in the year, we made some adjustments based on that, and we were basing it on being about 2% down overall. So we will make budget with what we've got, with what we have, because we did basically forecast that early in the season.
Down, so you're talking about down from the year before?
FY09 okay. License sales are approximately running about 2% behind FY08.
And just for the general group, what's your sense of why we're down? What are the various reasons?
A couple of things. Certainly the hurricane was our biggest impact in the early part of the year. Hurricane Ike really drove early license sales on the coast, and especially in the upper coast. There were some of those counties that license sales were 60% to 70% below normal. And then secondarily, as the economy started to catch up with us and the economic downturn, fuel costs and so forth during the middle portion of that, and then as November came around and the economy turned, you know, that kind of exacerbated the situation. We didn't catch up as quickly as we would have hoped to.
Dr. Falcone, any questions or comments?
I just appreciate the comments from the public on how we could potentially raise more money, because I think we're going to have to look at all kinds of different avenues on how to raise more money. We've been concerned about Fund 9 for at least 2 years that I've been on the commission, and what was going to happen with the monies available in the future. And so I certainly appreciate any comments and any help from the public on what we could potentially do to raise more money to continue
We have a group within the agency. It's a licensed team that is just a very, very energetic and inventive group of people that are looking at new opportunities. Of course, this Super Combo lottery came out of that group, and that group has got just so much energy and just looking at so many different opportunities out there. There's a new idea all the time, and we're vetting them and working through them as quickly as we can, and just because we need to look at all the opportunities and lots of different diversification of our revenue base.
Ongoing. Thank you. Any other questions for Gene before we vote on it? Do I have a motion? Motion from Commissioner Falcone, second by Commissioner Freakin. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Great. Thank you. Thank you, Gene. We'll move on to item number 5, local park grant funding for projects listed in the General Appropriations Act, TPWD Rider 34. Tim Hoxett's up. Tim?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. I'm Tim Hoxett, Director of Recreation Grants Program in the State Parks Division. The 80th Legislature, along with the competitive money that we were given for park grants, also gave us a list of 18 specific projects and $16.6 million to fund those. Specifically, the Appropriations Act reads, out of the funds appropriated for local park grants, the Department of Parks and Wildlife shall allocate $16,685,000 in matching grants for the following grants. The list included two projects that we're bringing to you today that have now submitted applications. The first one is for $200,000 for a community park in the city of Lancaster, which is in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And the second one is $200,000 in matching funds for Raymack Park, which is for the Airline Improvement District. That's a municipal improvement district in Harris County. And we're asking you specifically today to approve the motion that funding for the special appropriation rider projects as listed in Exhibit A are approved. And I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions for Tim? Okay. Didn't have anybody sign up to speak. Do I have a motion? Commissioner Hickson, seconded by Commissioner Falcone. All in favor? Any opposed? Thank you. Hearing none, motion carries.
Thank
you. Thanks, Tim. Item number 6, designation of nonprofit partners, has been withdrawn at this time. Item number 7, action, alligator proclamation, recommended adoption of proposed changes. Mr. Amos Cooper, please.
Mr. Chairman, fellow commissioners, my name is Amos Cooper, and I'm the Assistant Area Manager for the Upper Coast Wetland Ecosystem Project. And I'm here today to present the changes to the Alligator Proclamation. All alligators harvested in Texas must be tagged with the CITES hide tag because of similarity of appearance to endangered crocodilian elsewhere in the world. On public hunting land, there are two types of CITES hide tags for alligators. There's a commercial hide tag of $120. There's a not-for-sale tag at no cost. The proposed amendment would clarify that alligators taken on public land and initially tagged with a not-for-sale tag must be tagged with a commercial hide tag purchased from the department if the alligator is to enter commercial trade. We had a total of 49 public comments, and yours are going to be a little bit different. This was updated this morning. I think you had 27, but we had a 38 agreed and 11 disagreed with comments. Staff recommends that the Texas Park and Wildlife Commission adopt an amendment to 65.357 concerning purchase and sale of alligators, with changes that are necessary to the proposed text as published in the April 24, 2009 issue of the Texas Register. Any questions?
Any questions, comments? Yes, Commissioner Duggan.
What were the substance of the objections, the 11 objections you received?
There wasn't any continuity about it. It was all over the place. We had a couple that the rules were, they said it was poorly worded. There was two commenters that they were in agreement with it, but they didn't know they were after it was explained to them. Another comment was that they opposed the rule because they thought it would be too expensive to put into place. Another comment was it was against the commercial use of wildlife resources.
Thank you.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you. Excuse me. Oh, do I have a motion on this? Sorry. Do I have a motion on this? Good. Commissioner Bivens, second by Commissioner Duggins. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Motion carries. Great. Item number 8, action, public hunting lands for approval, open season on public hunting lands, public hunting activities on state parks. Ms. Linda Campbell. Linda.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Linda Campbell, Program Director for the Private Lands and Public Hunting Program in the Wildlife Division. I'm here today to request action on establishing an open season on public hunting lands and to present proposed public hunting activities on state parks. Establishing an open season on public hunting lands allows the department to hold public hunts during the upcoming hunting season beginning September 1st, 2009. Also, statute requires the commission to approve public hunting activities on units of the state park system. You've been provided the proposed state park hunts for the 2009-2010 season. Just briefly, there are a total of 1,676 hunt positions proposed on state parks, of which 253 are youth positions. This year, three state park units have returned to the public hunting program. They are Pardinalis Falls, Pardinalis Falls Annex, and Mother Neff State Park. Also this year, there are three new state parks proposing hunts. They are Palo Duro Canyon, Lake Texana, and Stephen F. Austin. Staff recommends the commission adopt the following motions. The first one, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission authorizes an open season on public hunting lands to run from September 1, 2009 to August 31, 2010. And the second motion, Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission authorizes the public hunting activities contained in Exhibit A to take place on units of the state park system. Any questions?
Comments for Linda on the public hunting? I'll have my usual comment.
Yes, sir.
Let's keep it growing.
Yes, sir.
And going. Congratulations. Yeah, I'm glad you're adding some new parks and putting some back in. That's great. Hopefully we can get this drought broken, and
yeah,
it'll help too.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Do I have a motion on this?
Move.
Commissioner Hickson, second. Commissioner Morian, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. This motion does carry. Thank you, Linda. Item number 9, action, deer tagging and documentation requirement, recommended adoption of proposed changes. Mr. Clayton Wolf. Clayton.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, my name is Clayton Wolf. I am the Big Game Program Director in the Wildlife Division. Yesterday, I presented to you several items and talked about some of the work of our Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee. I'm not going to go into the details that you've heard before, except to say a lot of work has taken place. Much of it is coming to fruition. Some of that through some statutory changes downtown that will become effective September 1st. However, there is one item and one recommendation from our advisory committee that this commission can address, because this commission has the authority to amend and modify tagging requirements. Carcass tagging requirements currently cease when a carcass is at a final destination and is processed for cooking or storage, and that carcass is beyond quarters. And of course, you may recall that the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee recognized that technically someone could be in violation of the law if they took a carcass down to quarters and put it in a freezer and didn't go beyond quarters. And so at least part of the attempt was to fix that little technical error. Previously, we proposed that carcass tagging requirements would cease when a carcass was at a final destination, was processed for cooking and storage, and at least one quarter had been removed. And after we proposed that initial amendment,
We learned there was a little bit of confusion over other documentation requirements, and as well we visited with law enforcement division, and they had some recommendations that would help enforcement and some clarity. And so with your permission, we went back to the Texas Register, and the current proposal before you is that carcass tagging, wildlife resource document, and proof of sex requirements would all cease when a carcass is at a final destination, the forequarters, hindquarters, and backstraps have been completely severed from the carcass. Additionally, tagging requirements, the WRD and proof of sex requirements, would cease at a cold storage or processing facility only if the carcass had been logged in a record book and the record book was required at that facility. We received 72 comments on this, 97% agree, 3% disagree, and of those that disagreed, they provided no specific rationale for their disagreement. Therefore, staff recommends that the Parks and Wildlife Commission adopt amendment to 65610 concerning possession of wildlife resources, with changes as necessary to the proposed text as published in the April 24, 2009 issue of the Texas Register. And with that, I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Clayton, you're being nice to us today.
Extremely.
any questions or comments for Clayton on this situation or any other for Deere? Thank you, Clayton.
Thank you.
And we do need a motion. Do I have a motion on S? Commissioner Barcone, second by Commissioner Friedman. All in favor?
Aye.
Motion does carry. Item number 10, action land exchange. Galveston County received 11 acres in exchange for 6 acres. Galveston Island State Park. Corky Coleman. Corky.
Good morning. For the record, Corky Coleman with the Land Conservation Program. This is a land transfer at Galveston Island State Park. Galveston is this island is southeast of Houston. You can see the exchange area by the magenta circle. It is across the county road from the Gulf and the beach part of the park. This item is that we would get Track 1, approximately 11 acres, from a private landowner in exchange for Track 2, where our current maintenance yard is, and the small section, which is Track 3. If you look in the before and after, the current boundary in that area is fairly erratic. After the exchange, it would be an even, smooth boundary. But it would create a private track completely separate from the rest of the park. In this exchange, the landowner will deed approximately 11 acres to Parks and Wildlife, pay a negotiated amount difference, pay all closing costs, surveying, appraisal costs, and clear the amphitheater site to Parks and Wildlife satisfaction. The theater site, the 11 acres which we'll be getting, is a liability not only to the owner, the current owner, but to Parks and Wildlife, because there's nothing to keep any park visitors from getting on it. And as you can see, it's rather shabby condition. Parks and Wildlife will lift any deed restrictions on the Stewart Mansion track and the theater site and receive or give 6.2 acres to the adjacent landowner to include the existing maintenance complex. The existing maintenance complex was damaged. It had about 5 or 6 foot of water in it, and we're not really losing anything. We're going to rebuild the park anyway. With that said, the motion the staff would like you to consider is the Texas, or recommends, that the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission finds that ownership of the 6.2-acre maintenance yard track at Galveston Island State Park is no longer in the best interest of Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, that there is no reasonable and prudent alternative to transfer ownership of the 6.2-acre track, and that the transfer of the 6.2-acre track in exchange for the 11-acre track and monetary consideration includes all reasonable planning to minimize harm to the park. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission therefore authorizes the executive director to take all necessary steps to exchange the 6.2-acre track for the 11-acre track, private track, and monetary consideration, and to remove deed restrictions from the tracks involved.
I've been a lawyer.
I think that's money in your pocket. I'll be glad to answer. We did have a public meeting Virtually nobody showed up at the public meeting. The Friends Group, Galveston Island State Park Friends Group, did write a letter in support of the exchange.
Any questions or comments for Corky? Commissioner Duggan.
I think the record should reflect the amount of the consideration being paid.
It's currently in the contract. The consideration that we have contracted for is $575,000.
Thank you.
Corky, thank you. Any other questions or comments for Corky? Thank you. Do I have a motion on this? Okay, Commissioner Martin, second. Commissioner Freakin, all in favor?
Aye.
This is a land transfer at Abilene State Park, Taylor County, Texas. The State Park and Boy Scout Camp is south of Abilene, Texas, at a little community called Buffalo Gap. We have a request from the Texas Trails Council, Boy Scouts of America, to donate or transfer approximately 91 acres of land. You can see the park in the green, and the outline of the red is the area that's being requested in the transfer. Here's a little closer shot of what the transfer property looks like. A little bit of history about the park and the Boy Scout land. This land was deeded to Parks and Wildlife in 1933, and CCC camp was set up to build the park, and they did build some infrastructure on the 91 acres that's to be transferred. People said that this particular track had been used by the Boy Scouts since 1929, and the city had given them an adjacent 40 acres that they do have D2 now. In 1949, we officially entered into a lease with the Scouts. That lease was renewed in 1956, and the current lease expires in the year 2018. If this transfer were to take place, Parks and Wildlife would place a conservation easement on the property, which would give Parks and Wildlife a say in land management issues, determine where new infrastructure could be built, and that would include new trails, new roads, and it would also protect all cultural and natural resources on the property, the CCC structures and archaeological sites that we've already documented. In addition to the conservation easement, there will be deed restrictions that state if it is no longer used as a Boy Scout camp, it will revert back to Parks and Wildlife, and that the land cannot be used as collateral on a loan. I'm going to make it easy on me on this one. Staff recommends that you adopt the motion before you. And I'll be glad to take any questions.
Any questions on this one for Corky? We do have one individual who wants to speak. Patrick Pace, please. Patrick Pace here.
I know Mr. Pace left Abilene this morning to get here. He's on his way, but unfortunately it doesn't look like he got here in time to speak. He had called me to say he was on his way.
Huh. Somebody put this name. And that's fine. He just indicated he's front and says he represents the Boy Scouts and he was for this. So.
Yes.
Okay. Great. Any other questions or comments? Okay, with that, need a motion, please. Commissioner Martin, second Commissioner Hickson, all in favor? Great. Corky, thanks for putting this together. This is a good deal for everybody. Okay, we're on number 12. Action item, acceptance of land donation, Bexar County, approximately 3,000 acres, Government Canyon State Natural Area. Mr. Ted Hollingsworth. Ted.
Chairman, Commissioners, good morning. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This item pertains to the second reading. This is the second time you've seen this. Regarding the donation of 3,000 acres of land from the city of San Antonio to Texas Parks and Wildlife. Several tracts, approximately 8 tracts, all contiguous with Government Canyon State Natural Area. Government Canyon State Natural Area is just, actually it's in San Antonio, but it's on the northwest border of San Antonio. These tracts are all contiguous with the state natural area. They're all high quality habitat. They were acquired by the city with prop monies to protect the aquifer but they also have very high potential for conservation and recreation. The tracks would be transferred to us in fee simple. They would have restrictions on them because of the occurrence of the golden cheek warbler. The restrictions would be essentially identical to those that are already on the majority of the state natural area because of its occupancy by the endangered species. We are currently working on a habitat management plan that would become part of the agreement. And we would be able to develop trails, wayside exhibits, picnic areas, such things at our discretion. But the intent would be that the property would be made available to the public. The city has agreed that we could also hunt that property. Not a lot of hunt opportunities in the immediate vicinity of San Antonio, but with 11,000 contiguous acres, it would be a rare opportunity. We've had several comments since I prepared this slide, 100% of those comments in favor of the transfer. Staff recommends that you adopt this motion. The executive director is authorized to take all necessary steps to accept the donation of approximately 3,000 acres of land in Bexar County for addition to Government Canyon State Natural Area. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Any questions from the commissioners? I do have one individual I'd like to speak to, Sandy Jenkins from the City of San Antonio. Sandy here?
Good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. I'm Sandy Jenkins, and I'm just here to express the city's interest in making this deal happen. It would be a great benefit to the citizens of San Antonio. We have had one public hearing in April. We will have another one in June, and we have had no opposition at all. And so we're looking forward to making this happen.
Wonderful. Any questions for Sandy?
Thank you
for taking the time coming down. The City of San Antonio has been great to work with, I mean, this is pretty amazing when you think about it, in a major metropolitan area to be able to do this, put this kind of state natural area together. And now with adding the 3,000, would you say 11,000 contiguous acres, isn't that right? That's wonderful. Any other questions or comments? Great. So I need a motion.
So moved.
So moved. Commissioner Hickson, I'm glad you did that. Commissioner Falcone, fine. Seconds, all in favor? Aye, okay. Any opposed? Thank you. This motion does carry. Thank you, Ted. You're up for 13, it looks like. Acceptance of land donation and land exchange from Brazos River Authority, Palo Pinto County, approximately 700 acres for 200 acres of submerged lands at Possum Kingdom State Park. Ted, you're putting together good deals here, buddy. Anyway, Ted's up. Thanks.
Chairman, Commissioners, good morning. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This is the second time you've seen this item. It's a proposal to exchange some submerged land that we own at Possum Kingdom State Park for some uplands. This is in Palo Pinto County, about 60 miles west of Fort Worth. The initial transaction, the phase one transaction, and we have had surveyors on the ground now, would transfer approximately 300 acres to Texas Parks and Wildlife. The submerged tract, which is entirely below the pool elevation of Possum Kingdom Lake, is about 160 acres. The other piece of this that the Brazos River Authority would like in exchange is for us to make an easement on an existing water pipeline, a permanent no fee. It's about 900 feet. It just crosses one tiny corner of the park. The land, as is much of the park now, would be controlled by FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which would constrain it to low-impact recreational development, which of course would be our intent for the property anyway. That northern tract, that what we call the thumb that sticks out into the lake, is the tract that would be exchanged, would come to Texas Parks and Wildlife in the first transaction. We are exploring the potential for adding an additional 300 to 350 acres of uplands, undeveloped uplands, that would also make a very good conservation and recreation property. As you can see, the tract that would go back to the Brazos River Authority, would go to the Brazos River Authority, is entirely underwater and is currently serving no purpose for the park. And here's the location of the pipeline in question. I get a deep breath here. Staff recommends you adopt the following motion. The executive director is authorized to take all necessary steps to accept the donation of 700 plus or minus acres of land in Palo Pinto County for addition to Possum Kingdom State Park. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission finds ownership of the approximately 200 acres of submerged land in Palo Pinto County to no longer be in the interest of Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, that there is no reasonable and prudent alternative to the transfer of ownership of approximately 200 acres of submerged land, and that the transfer of approximately 200 acres includes all reasonable planning to minimize harm to the park, and the commission authorizes the executive director to transfer said approximately 200 acres of land to the Brazos River Authority. I would not be happy to repeat that, but I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions or comments? Mr. Duggan.
The easement would be for a water line?
It's an existing water line, yes, sir.
But would this be a written easement agreement?
There is an existing written easement agreement. We would amend it so that instead of cycling every 10 years, it would simply be a permanent agreement.
And would it be limited to a water line and not permit lines to transfer hydrocarbons or electrical power? I mean,
yes,
is it limited?
Yes, sir, exactly. It would be constrained to the existing water line and existing water line only.
Thank you. Chairman, Commissioners, good morning. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This is a recommendation to acquire by purchase a little over 700 acres for addition to Lost Maples State Natural Area in Bandera County, a very popular state natural area, a short day trip west of San Antonio. The tract in question you can see is approximately 732 acres. The owner has been extremely cooperative. The way the acquisition is structured, we would buy 600 acres of that immediately. We have an option to buy an additional 100 acres that we would plan to exercise in September with the new fiscal year. The balance of that, the 30-plus acres, the landowner will be donating to Texas Parks and Wildlife to make this acquisition whole. The important thing about the acquisition is that we can use the extra elbow room at the state natural area, but more importantly, it gives us the entire Can Creek drainage, which is the primary canyon that runs through the park and really gives it its spectacular hill country views. A large population of endangered golden-cheek warblers. No one is claiming any regulatory credit for that. That's simply a biological plus with the addition. And staff does recommend that you adopt the following motion. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission authorizes the executive director to take all necessary steps to acquire a 732 plus or minus acre tract as an addition to the Lost Maples State Natural Area. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Questions, comments? Commissioner Bivens, second by Commissioner Martin, all in favor? Any opposed? Okay, with that, motion carries. Thank you. Wow, Carter, you're really nice to us.
Well, we're just trying to make it easy on you on a Thursday, so I think we're done.
The commission has completed its business. I declare us adjourned.